My name's Tim, if I haven't had the chance to meet you before. Here we are in our second week of this thing called the Summer Series. And as Jamie's already mentioned, the topic for tonight is religion and war. This was the second top ticked box in the survey as we asked the people around the coast what they'd like to hear a talk on. So here we go. Now, as Jamie mentioned, after I speak for a little bit, there'll be a chance to answer some questions. So fire away. Can't promise I'll be able to answer them all, but I'll give it a crack. All right? My guess on why this was such a ticked box on the survey is that there's a very common perception among our community, and maybe you've heard it, and it goes something like this. Religion causes all the wars. I've heard it many times from good friends and people I know, the claim that it is religion really that's the problem with our world, causing all the conflict and all the wars. And if you believe that, then you'd probably come to the conclusion that we'd be better off without organised religion, wouldn't we? And there are many people who hold that view. And if that's your view and you're here with us tonight, good on you for being here. It's a big thing, I know, to walk through the doors of a church that looks like an organised religion and think about this topic. So bless you for being here. I hope my comments and words will be helpful for you. I watched a movie this week where one of the women in the movie described herself as a Buddhist, and the reason why she decided to become a Buddhist, she said, was because Buddhism is not an organised religion, it's a peaceful philosophy. And she liked that instead of being part of an organised religion, because organised religions end up causing division and conflict and war. And when you hear it like that, it sounds right. It sounds nice. I'd rather be part of a peaceful philosophy when you kind of put it like that. And particularly when you look around in the world at the moment and you see a lot of the carnage that's going down, particularly in nations beyond us, terrorism, it's seemingly caused by religious motivations. Terrorists that are Islamic State. And so it's easy to hear a thought like that and go, yeah, totally. Maybe if we just get rid of religion, it'll make the place more peaceful. Is religion the cause of all the wars? Is religion a major cause of all the wars? Let's just start by considering that claim, because it's certainly out there and I hear it all the time. Let's think into it for a little bit. The first thing to acknowledge is whenever you look at a war, it's always complex, and so there are always multiple factors that contribute to the cause of any given war. But if we ask the question, where are the wars where religion is the major cause, the primary cause? Let's think them through. What are the wars that you know of in your mind? Let's just think of the more recent ones that we might be aware of. The war in Iraq. Primary cause religious? No. The Gulf War? No. The Libyan or Somalian civil wars that have been going on for a while? No. Vietnam War? Korean War? The Cold War? What about the big ones? World War II? No. World War I? No. The Boer War? No. What about all the big revolutions? The Russian Revolution? The French Revolution? The American Revolution? Are any of those caused by religious motivations? No. How far have you got to go back before you find a war where the primary cause is religious? I reckon you've got to go back about 1,000 years and then you'll find some. Yeah? So maybe a lot of you are thinking the Crusades. Yeah. Yeah, I reckon you could argue primary cause of war, in the Crusades and perhaps the Inquisition, religious. Yeah. So there are some. Absolutely, you don't want to deny that. But what kind of proportion do you reckon? Of all the wars in human history, could you say religious war?
Because you might be surprised, because as historians, who are the guys who are meant to know what they're talking about, sit down and look through human history and look at the cause of the major wars they're aware of and add them up, they all come to a pretty similar conclusion. I'll give you one of them, and I've shared this with you before. So Charles Philip and Alan Axelrod looked at the history of recorded warfare and put together their three-volume work called The Encyclopedia of Wars. Kind of obvious topic, right? They looked at and identified 1,763 wars in human history that we know of. And of that 1,763, only 123 were caused by religious motivations, or where religious cause was part of the reason. It's still 123, but it's 123 of 1,763, which is, if you can do the maths in your head, less than 7% of all of the wars in human history are for religious reasons. Now, if maths and figures doesn't really kind of do it for you, but graphics do, here's a pie chart that just kind of pops that out for you, right? You can see that piece of the pie that's been pulled out there. That's the religious wars. And there's actually a little bit of something we need to talk about there as to which religions have caused more of the religious wars. I'll get to that in a minute, but let's just start by looking at the majority of the pie, the orange. 93% of all the wars in human history, non-religious cause, secular wars. And as you look into all the reasons why, most of the historians would kind of use the word nationalism to describe the main reason why nations go to war. And the concept of nationalism has lots of different kinds of expressions. It might mean, you know, going in and trying to conquest someone else's territory, or just patrol your own borders, or secure a trade route through another country, which is for economic gain, or, you know, subsistence in your own country, civil war, ethnic cleansing. But good old-fashioned nationalism, people would say, is the primary cause of 93% of all the wars in human history. So there it is. And there's different historians that kind of look at it from different angles, but the general picture is that, and you can look into it, and I'm pretty sure that's what you'll find. So, as to the claim that religion causes all the wars, it's not true. Religion doesn't even cause most of the wars. It is a cause of some wars. It's just a very small. It's still 7%, but it's a very minor cause of all the wars. So there's that one. So next time someone says to you, yes, religion caused all the wars, you can say 7%, less than 7%. That's just what the historians are saying. So why is it that we live in a community that wants to say that religion causes all the wars when it's simply not true? That's a question to consider. Let me just say a few things about that 7%. You pop that back up, Sean. Of the 7% of religious wars, 4% of that 7%, so more than half of the religious wars, are Islamic wars, so caused by one particular religion. All the other religions combined together contain that next 3%. Yeah? So 3% of all the wars have been caused by religions like Christianity, with the Crusades. But you'd be surprised to know that there are other religions who we usually consider to be quite peaceful that actually have caused wars. So Hinduism. And guess what? Buddhism. And if you're in denial about Buddhism right now, Google the 969 movement and have a look at what's happening in Burma at the moment. Or just dig in and see what's happening in Sri Lanka at the moment, where Buddhist monks together with government officials, are actually perpetrating violence and persecution upon Christians in Sri Lanka at the moment. It's shocking, isn't it? We have these ideas about different organisations that are more peaceful than others, but it would appear that every religion is open to some kind of a radical or more extreme fringe that use their teachings to justify violence in some way. Every religion has that. And why is that? 4% being Islamic wars, that is something worth noticing. So Islam has caused more wars than all of the other religions put together. That's worth noticing. Why is that? Islam seems to somehow provide more opportunity for its extreme or radical fringe to use its teachings to justify violence. Some people would say, yeah, Islam is the problem with the world. I don't think that's the case. But I'd say Islam has a problem. Clearly, history shows Islam has more of a problem than the other religions. Why is that? Well, I reckon you want to talk to someone who's an expert in Islam to get a good answer to why that might be. We had one here with us about a year ago now who came and spoke to us, I think, in detail about Islam, one of those hot topic nights, and you can dig in and look at that. I've learned a lot of things from that night and through other readings. My big gut would be, well, you look at the founder of a religion, and when you look into the founder of Islam, you see Muhammad, who actually towards the end of his life particularly became a powerful military leader with a sword in his hand. And my best guess would be it's things like that that give people, you know, more apparent opportunity. But I don't want to claim to be an expert in Islam by any means, but simply notice that one. That's worth noticing. But come back to the big point that I really wanted to start by making, and that is religion is not the major cause of wars. We've got to let that one die. Now, some of you hear that and go, okay, all right, so religion may not be the cause of all the wars, but religion certainly does seem to divide people, and so therefore religion just causes division and angst amongst people. And a lot of really kind of popular atheists at the moment have written books just really kind of criticising religion as being the big problem. And if we could get rid of it, the place would just be far more peaceful. So, you know, Christopher Hitchens writes his book, God is Not Great, which is all about how religion poisons everything. Now, Christopher Hitchens is not alive anymore, and so he's found out whether God is great or not. Yeah. But many people would just kind of agree with that sentiment and say, yeah, you know what? We would be better off as a society without religion because it just causes trouble. And if that's you, if you're thinking, yeah, I do think we'd be better off. This place would just be more peaceful. There'd be less angst, less divisions if we just got rid of particularly organised religion. If that's you, can I just ask you to consider two things with me just now? Firstly, can you please consider the great good that organised religion does contribute to society? I'm thinking particularly about Western society as we know it, and particularly about our own nation. It is the case that Christianity, you know, forms the very foundation of the society that we live in, and is largely responsible for developing schooling and education and providing schools and building hospitals and healthcare and providing social welfare. Christianity has driven those things. So you want to be careful before you say, let's get rid of Christianity. Religion, like Christianity, has driven art and culture. Christianity has provided the ethical foundations for our society, the law and justice system, are based on biblical principles. And that's just looking at one organised religion. I read an article in the Sydney Morning Herald a couple of weeks back explaining why it's important to give organised religions tax exemptions, which every year gets suggested we need to pull those tax exemptions from organised religions. And the person was just writing the article saying, okay, let's picture what we would do, what would happen to our society if you cause religious organisations or non-for-profit organisations to kind of stumble. And they put forward a pretty convincing case. You know, the top 25 charities, non-for-profit organisations in our country that actually provide for people in need, not the Shane Warne kind of charity that just kind of, you know, gives his mates a couple of free dinners. Sorry, that's a little dig, but I thought you'd be with me on that one anyway. of the top 25, you know, 22 of them are religious. You know, that's the basis for our charitable organisations. So think about what would happen. Pull all the tax exemption for organised religion. It's likely the case that a lot of social welfare charities that contribute greatly to our society would stumble, possibly crumble. A lot of schooling would stumble and crumble. A lot of hospitals and healthcare would stumble and crumble. In fact, the government and the leadership of our nation know that full well, which is why they never will. Because they know that if all those things stumbled and crumbled, and religious organisations and all the good that they do were removed from society, our government would not be able to support education and schooling or healthcare or welfare in our society. It would not be able to pull it off. So that's just kind of to throw that out there and say, please don't be naive about considering the reality of the great good that organised religions like Christianity have given to our society and continue to contribute to our society, let alone the very foundations and basis. So there's just one point. We don't want to be naive about that. Second point is this. If you still think, nah, we'd still be better off, how would you go about getting rid of religions anyway? How would you go about just kind of ridding society from organised religions? Probably the best way to do it would be just to outlaw organised religion. Yeah, make it illegal and actually just remove it by force. And as you start to consider what that would take, you realise, oh, we've actually been attempting that. Well, certain nations have actually been attempting that over the last century to remove religion by force, and it's gone terribly badly. Yeah? Just consider the philosophies or the regimes of socialism or communism. They more often lead to a totalitarianism with a dictatorship that's super harsh. In fact, that kind of regime and that kind of philosophy has led to more carnage and more horror than anything else in the last 100 years. Think about Cambodia and Pol Pot. I think 2 million people slaughtered under that regime. Or communist China with Chairman Mao. They estimate 38 million people slaughtered. Or communist Russia under Stalin. They reckon 43 million people slaughtered. Hasn't gone so well. Pretty horrific, actually. Attempts to rid the world of religion by force have caused unimaginable horror. They estimate 100 million slaughtered in the last century. So could I humbly propose, getting rid of religion, particularly by force, cannot be the answer to the problem of a world that's always in conflict. And here's the thing, our world does have a problem. The world we live in clearly has a problem. You look back through human history, there's never been a moment where there hasn't been people at war somewhere, let alone in multiple places. Our world is constantly at war with itself. There's conflict left, right, and centre. And it's one thing, here's the deal, it's one thing to acknowledge it being out there on an international level. But then we also notice, well, actually, it's on a national level, isn't it, as well? We see kind of corruption in our own government and leadership in our nation that horrifies us sometimes. And then you bring it down to a local level. Domestic violence is such a big issue. Yeah? Child abuse continues to be a big issue. You know, there's conflict and violence and the problem of war right down on a personal level. What about you and your friends or your family? How'd Christmas go? Is there some conflict there? Some warfare there? Can you see it coming right down? Our world is a problem. It's everywhere. We're at war. We want peace. Where's that found? What's the answer to getting rid of war and conflict and carnage? Where can peace be found? Well, every different religion offers a different answer. And the answer that Christianity offers is very unique from every other religion. Because the solution that Christianity offers diagnoses the problem differently from every other religion. We read from Mark chapter 7 just a minute ago. So if you've got your Bible, open that up. It's in your EV News. I might get Sean to see if he can follow me along. But come and have a look at how Christianity diagnoses the problem with the world we live in, because it's clearly got a problem. Mark chapter 7, let me give you a quick little bit of context. The religious leaders at the time are actually criticizing Jesus because his followers are not following all their religious traditions. Yeah, particularly this thing about having unwashed hands before you eat. And they're beating up on Jesus about it. Now, this tradition that they're trying to enforce upon everyone was not part of the original law. It was something that was added over time and that they wanted to enforce upon everyone who claimed to be Jewish. Now, you might hear that and think, yeah, it's that kind of stuff. That's ridiculous. I hate that man-made tradition that gets imposed upon people. And if that's you, just so you know, Jesus is with you on that one. Jesus actually agrees that man-made tradition being enforced upon people is a shocker. In fact, he spent most of his time being hostile and critiquing the religious leaders of his time. And actually, he spent time doing this through chapter 7, telling them how silly it is that they get so caught up in these external observances that they do whilst they fail to do the very core things of life that are more important. But you get to verses 14 and 15, and Jesus puts his finger right on it. He tells us where the problem really is, and he gets really personal, and he kind of goes deep. And so 14 and 15, I mean, read 15, Jesus says, "Nothing outside a person can defile them by going into them. Rather, it is what comes out of a person which defiles them," which is Jesus saying, you know where corruption, which is the concept of defiling, you know where corruption for our world and corruption even on the personal level comes from? You know how people get corrupted? It's not out there coming at you. It's from in here. That's where the problem is. Now, the specific instance here, he's talking about food and things like that. So you skip down to verses, you know, 17, 18. Look, he's really having a go. Are you so dull? Look, don't you see that nothing that enters a person from the outside can defile them? And here's why food can't defile you. Because it does not go into the heart, but into the stomach. So there Jesus says, here's the problem. A person gets corrupted when their heart gets corrupted. And when he talks about the word heart in the Bible, it's not your physical heart. He's talking about the very center of your being, where you hold your beliefs and your desires. It's where you are a real person. It's the core of your personhood, your heart. And Jesus says when your heart gets corrupted, that's how a whole person gets corrupted, and that's how society gets corrupted. But where does that corruption come from? Well, the devastating diagnosis is Jesus says, it comes from within you. I mean, how much more would we prefer to hear that humanity is essentially good, but we just get corrupted by the environment that we're in? I could hear that all day long, because that just tells me I'm okay. It's the people out there, and it's the education system out there. It's all those things out there that wreck me. Now, no doubt, you are influenced, absolutely, by the family you grew up in, the environment you're in, absolutely. But Jesus says, you know, the big problem that causes the corruption in a person doesn't come from out there. It comes from within. And look at verses 20 and 21. He makes it really clear. It's from within. It's out of a person's heart that evil thoughts come. And then he lists all this list of evil thoughts, which we'd love to think are just out there somewhere. And we somehow picked up on them as the years tick by. But Jesus goes, now that stuff comes from within you. Which, just hear this really clearly. Jesus would say, the Bible would say, the problem is not a religious problem. It's not to do with an organization or a structure in society. The problem's not out there. The problem is a person problem. It's a people problem. And the funny thing is, wherever you find people, you find the problem. And you know why you find issues with religions? It's because they've got people in them. And if the problem originates with people, then wherever you find people, you're going to find the problem. It's so unflattering to hear Jesus diagnose the issue with the world like this. But if it's true, the last thing you want to do is spend your whole life trying to fix the issues simply looking at external things and society and programs, which can be helpful. But to think that that is where the solution lies for the world and for you is to misdiagnose the problem. It's to miss where it really originates. And Jesus goes, it's in here. The problem's in your heart. The corruption comes from within. And here's where the amazing news of the Bible comes. Jesus is not just simply the one who kind of points at the problem and goes, it's you, and then walks off. He goes, it's you, and I've come to fix you. And that's the coolest thing about biblical Christianity you won't see anywhere else in any other religion, is God comes to fix the real problem, the problem of the heart. And Jesus comes and provides a solution for the real issue. And I'd say he does it on provides the solution or the answer on two levels. He provides forgiveness and he provides, transformation. That's the word. Forgiveness and transformation. Yeah? And here's the message of the Bible. God comes to us. You know, the Son of God comes, takes on a human body and actually goes and stands in our place and takes what we deserve, which is what the cross is all about. He dies, and what's laid upon him on the cross is not just physical pain. It's the spiritual pain of the punishment we deserve for our corruption. He takes it, he deals with it. And here's where the solution is then offered to a broken humanity. Jesus says, you come, you put your trust in me, and you can receive forgiveness and transformation. Forgiveness, because Jesus says, I stood in your place. I took the punishment you deserve. Come and be forgiven. Know that there's no condemnation for you anymore if you've put your trust in what I did for you on the cross. And then there's transformation, which doesn't mean the minute you put your trust in Jesus, boom, you just turn into this perfect person. You've only got to follow a Christian around for about 3 minutes before you figure out that ain't the truth. You know, I love that sticker that goes on the back of someone's car. Not perfect, just forgiven. You know, in other words, sorry, I'm doing bad things still. And you become a Christian, you don't become perfect overnight, but what happens is the amazing truth, the spiritual truths of the Bible. Jesus comes to live by his Spirit in you, in your heart, and he begins that transformation process, which he will bring to completion on the final day, which means there's hope that your desires that apparently are corrupted, they can be changed, that your thoughts can be changed, that your beliefs can be changed. There's hope for us. There's hope for us that our corruption can be transformed, and that's what God's in the business of doing. So there you go. There's the Bible's answer to the problem with the world. Diagnoses the problem. It's not out there. It's not a religious problem. It's a people problem. And Jesus comes with the solution. Now I'm going to pause there for a minute because that may have opened up a bunch of questions and thoughts. I'm kind of hoping we've got some questions that have come through. If we don't, I'm happy to just open up to the floor. Maybe you've thought of one right now and I'll have a crack and see if we can answer them. Jamie, have you?
Yeah, we've got a couple. This one, a couple of people want to know this one. Did you intentionally wear that war shirt to go with the war theme?
I'm just glad we're getting some serious questions coming through. I wish I was that organised, actually. I often can't be organised to get the slides to match my message, let alone my wardrobe to match my message, but by God's providence, look what he's done. Well, yeah, go on. You got another one?
Yeah.
embarrassed.
Here's one here. How do Christians explain the Old Testament carnage that God brings and commands his people to lead and conquer through?
Excellent. I was hoping that question would come in because that's the obvious one, I reckon. What about in the Old Testament where God commands his people to go to war? The answer is not a simple one. It's a complex one. Let me just attempt to give you a few things about considering that one. First of all, I'd ask you the question, can it ever be the case that war can be justified? Because this thing called just war theory, can you think of the kind of conditions where it might be justified to call to arms and go to war? I mean, I can think of a few situations that would call that, particularly the concept where a certain people are being threatened by invading armies. Would it not be right
to actually call to arms and actually, for the protection of those people, push back the invading armies. Think Nazi Germany. They invade Poland, and the Allied forces decide that's enough and go in and push them back. It is the case that sometimes war can be justified. But in saying that, war is always horrible. War can't not be brutal, because it involves the leaders or the generals of a war being very decisive and deliberate and just making a call. So it's always horrific. And I think sometimes being in the Western culture, not having experienced war and horror and oppression ourselves, it's easy for us to look back in history to the ancient world, or look into other nations at the moment around the world and shake our heads kind of from this lofty position where we've never experienced war, saying, dude, we should never go to war. But we don't know what it's like to experience the horror of oppression and brutality. It can be justifiable to go to war. Now, thinking particularly about God calling his own people to go to war, there's a couple of things that need to be acknowledged. First of all, he did not call his people to go to war for ethnic reasons or belief reasons. It was a moral reason. You see, what was happening in Canaan at the time, you get this in Genesis chapter 15, that the sin of the Canaanites had reached its full and God had been patient for many years. And so he decides to actually send his people in there as a form of him judging them for their sinfulness, using the instrument of his own people. And it is important for us to acknowledge that there are sometimes things, this wickedness that can be present in a nation that needs to be snuffed out. Yeah, there was oppression, there was child abuse, child sacrifice on a level that we've never even gone close to experiencing. And that's actually what was going on in Canaan. So it was a moral issue. Secondly, I'd say God didn't send his people in to make this rash reaction. They were actually to be very considered in their approach. And you actually get in Deuteronomy 40 that there was rules of engagement that they were to use. There was to be the offer of peace beforehand. So there's things like that, which are actually really unique for God's people in the ancient world, that there would be an offer of peace. There's a few other things. I'll say one more thing. Is it not the case that if there is a God and that he is powerful and that he is the Lord of all humanity, that it's not right for him to judge the wickedness of humanity and even to judge particularly the particular wickedness of a particular nation, and for him to use whatever instrument he wanted to do that? And so you see this in the Bible. Sometimes he uses his own people to judge the wickedness of a foreign nation. But catch this, sometimes he even uses a foreign nation to judge the wickedness of his own people. And if he is the Lord of humanity, does he not have the right to judge our wickedness? Now, it's not a simple answer, but it's a crack at it. And I was hoping that question would come in, and I hope that's helpful. Have you got another one?
Yeah. Isn't the real problem just with the radical religious views? Bit of a comment, what would you?
Good. So sometimes it's suggested that the problem's not just with religion generally, it's with that fringe of radical, extremist fringe. Now, it depends how you define the extremists. See, extremists in one religion look very different to another religion. Yeah, so extremists in Islam will think, need to form an Islamic state, need to demand people convert to Islam, otherwise we'll kill them, and we need to slay the infidels. That's what the extremists will think. And so an extremist Islamic person is likely to justify violence. An extremist Christian is going to stand on a milk crate and preach at you and try to love you to death. That's the worst you're ever going to get from an extremist Christian. And anyone who's tried to justify violence in the name of Jesus is tripping big time. You know, Jesus was the one who, the only time his followers ever tried to get violent was in the Garden of Gethsemane when he was about to be arrested. And Peter pulls out a sword, tries to swaps the soldier's ear off, and they're going to go for it. Jesus just simply turns and says, "Put your swords away. Put your swords away." So you can't justify violence from Christianity. So, you know, extremism looks different in different religion, but it, the thing that often lies behind that comment, if I can babble for a bit, fundamentalism or extremism or radicalism is seen as the problem, and what lies behind that is this absolute truth concept in every religion. And some people say that's the problem. You've got to get rid of these people who think that they've got the truth and other people are wrong. So you've got to get rid of this concept of right and wrong, true and false, in or out. And if we can get rid of that, and we can all just be pluralistic about truth claims, then society would be a better place. If we actually went down that road as a society to try to remove absolute truth claims, can you think into what that would mean? It would kind of gut religions altogether. I think everyone would be moderate. Everyone would just be obsessed with acknowledging that there are many paths and there's no differences really. So I think it would gut the actual action that you see religions actually bringing that are good on society. Can you imagine what if we actually raise the next generation without absolute truth, which is kind of happening on some level? I think we dabble with removing absolute truth. We think we're doing it, but no one's actually doing it. Imagine raising the next generation to not think anything was right or wrong, not think that it matters that you respect your elders or are loyal to anything. If you actually did that, we'd be so shocked, and we are shocked sometimes at what's happening with the next generation. Because it would cause massive issues. One more thing. Think about what that would mean for our country with its leadership if, say, the politicians never hold to any absolute truth claims. So they make a promise, can't hold them to it, which you kind of can't do anyway, right? But imagine if that, what about our law court system? Imagine if our judges couldn't hold to right or wrong, or false or true, and they had to simply go with whatever helps everyone get along. Oh, it'd be a shocker. And I actually don't think anyone really knows what they mean when they say, let's get rid of absolute truth and go after pluralism, because it actually just would not work as a society. We all hold to absolute truth. And actually, the claim to be pluralistic is a claim to absolute truth in and of itself, so it's inconsistent. So that I think that's often the argument that goes behind that question, if that's what you're asking. Anyway.
There's a bunch that's come through. I might give you two more. Is that cool?
Yep.
Yep. This one just came through. Is God still in control when millions die in war?
Is God still in control?
Yeah, when millions die in war.
When millions die in war. Yeah. So if God is real and he's powerful and he's good, why can't he just come in and just stop war? End war. Why can't God just end evil, boom, like that? Well, he can, and he's promised that he will. Yeah? And wouldn't it be wonderful? Imagine no more conflict in the Middle East. Imagine no more terrorism. Imagine no more corruption in our own country. Imagine no more domestic abuse. Imagine no more child abuse. Imagine all that gone. It would be wonderful. So on one level, we're kind of like, oh, please, Lord, come and do that. Come and rid the world of evil. But here's the little glitch in that one, is calling for God to come and rid the world of evil. Did you see how Jesus diagnosed the problem with the world? He goes, you're part of it. We're all part of the problem. So to call God to come and put an end to evil actually means we go too. But that's where comes the astonishing message of biblical Christianity. It says, no, there's actually a way to avoid the judgment for the evil, your own personal, that you deserve. And it's Jesus. That's the incredible claim. So that you can actually put your trust in Jesus and trust that actually what you deserve is actually being poured out on him, so that when God comes on that final day to bring complete judgment and get rid of evil, you'll survive. You'll escape. That's an astonishing claim. It's a unique claim that only the Bible makes. So, yeah.
I think we're good, because my next one was, why doesn't he just end it all? So I think you nailed that then.
That was the next question too.
So I think we're good.
Okay. I reckon we've got time for one more, if there's anyone sitting there who wants to just have a crack. Anyone busting down something?
Here we go. Should Christians be conscientious objectors, people who object to serving in armed forces on the grounds that it's against their consciences?
Yeah, Good call. That's a good question. Should Christians ever go to war? The problem with talking about the just war theory is that the situation, the context that brings about war is always complex. It's never just a simple thing. So it's hard for a Christian to look and go, yep, definitely wrong, I'll join and push evil back. There's always a complexity going on. So I would say to that question, is it ever okay for Christians to serve in armed war? Yes. Yes, it is. Is it clear to know when is a good time and when is the time to pull out? That's tricky. That's really complex. But even for the Christian who says, yes, I will go and fight because I think it's right to do everything we can to stop that because that is horrific, the Christian needs to understand what you're about to step into is a brutality you've never experienced before that will change you radically. You know, it's gonna mess with you. And anyone who goes to war just knows that full well. So it's a tricky thing. So yes, but it's not easy to tell. Is that? Yeah, cool. So let me just pray. But before I pray, let me just kind of remind you of where we landed, where I tried to land today. There's a really common perception in our world that there's a problem. And there is a problem. Our world has a problem. But the Bible diagnoses the problem by getting personal and says it's not just out there. In fact, the core of the problem is in here, which is unflattering to hear, hard to hear. But if that's the truth, how wonderful is it that God would diagnose it clearly for us and then come with a proper antidote, a proper solution, which is Jesus. Which is why we just keep wanting to hold out Jesus, because he's the one who actually comes and brings the offer of forgiveness and real transformation. There's the answer the Bible gives. How about I pray? Father, we thank you for your word to us, though it is hard to hear. But on another level, it's wonderful to hear that you see the problem in the world even with better clarity than we do. And you actually see the very cause of the problem. It's our own corrupted hearts. It's what you call sin. Please help us to accept your diagnosis and run to you for the cure. Amen.